The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. Let me turn my mic down just a tad. Just about blew out my my eardrums there. In any event, we're having some exciting times here at Edstone and at God's College with Thanksgiving ball last night. I guess they had theirs at headquarters Sunday. And then we had ours last night, a small, intimate gathering. A beautiful and wonderful and tasty dinner together with some fun and entertainment out on the dance floor. So we enjoyed that. A little bit tired today, enjoying the leftovers of the turkey dinner for lunch this afternoon as well. Lots to get to on today's program. A couple of follow-up stories from yesterday, the transformation of morality. We talked about that, this transformation that's going on in America and the U.K., And I think a story that came across my desk this morning really does tie in with that, as does another one on the judicial activism, or in the words of Daniel Horowitz at Conservative Review, judicial dictatorship, another example of that in the news just yesterday. We'll also be discussing on today's program the European transformation. We've been right on top of this over the last couple of weeks. My father has this new article coming out in the January issue of the Trumpet magazine, Germany, a new king is imminent. That'll be posted at thetrumpet.com probably in the next week or two. But it's a great article talking about the prophecies that so many of you are familiar with, Daniel 8 and Daniel 11, about the new strong man that's prophesied to appear in Germany. But more broadly, it just speaks of this seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, and how that so many people today are just completely unaware of this history. And here it is happening, this prophecy, this history repeating itself. It's happening right before our eyes. My father makes an incredible statement at the end of that article, something to the effect, I have it in my notes later, but something to the effect that the Holy Roman Empire is now here. This seventh and final resurrection, it's here. It is upon us. Together with that article, we'll also study into a chapter that many of you are familiar with, Revelation chapter 17, about the beast and the woman straddling the beast. We'll take it. We'll take our study through that verse by verse. Well, yesterday, as I mentioned, we went through this this transformation in American morality. Same with Britain. And we asked at the Trumpet several years ago. Well, not even several years ago. We asked, I think, in 2016, where will we be in 5 years? What will it be like? Just look at the progression over the last generation or so, to go from a traditional Judeo-Christian family, then to a non-religious family, then the dysfunctional family, divorce, fatherlessness, fornication, adultery, homosexuality, bisexuality, and on it goes, all the way to the point of what we're seeing now in the news almost every day, certainly here in the UK, one story after another about transgenderism. And not just that, but for little children, look at the trajectory that we're on. And as I say, where will we be a few years from now? The Telegraph had an article yesterday saying in 10 years we'll ask how we allowed the trans lobby to hijack childhood. How do we let this happen? How did we let this activist group, this tiny, tiny, tiny little sliver of society, hijack childhood? How could we sit back and just watch it happen and do nothing about it? There was a story, I forget which paper it was here in the UK, but it was a whistleblower that came forward from this school where 17 children are transitioning to the opposite sex. And she came forward to blow the whistle, saying that that many of these children are autistic. It says here in the Telegraph, convinced that autistic children who are not transgender are being exploited by the transgender lobby and brainwashed into believing that they are, the teacher detailed how 9 of the 18 children she had seen identify as transgender in the school had been officially diagnosed with autism, while the rest had shown definite signs of the condition. So here they have these complex mental health issues, as the article explains, and yet they're being groomed by other people to transition, to be a transgender. It says one autistic teenager, born a girl, was already planning to have a double mastectomy. Others, she believes, were taking puberty-blocking drugs, unbeknown to their parents, the article says further on. So this is going on at schools. In some cases, they're being urged to transition, these children with autism. And of course, the parents are left out. The parents can't be told. The parents have no rights. They have no rights to learn about what their children are doing at school, even if it involves transitioning to the opposite sex. It says this expose comes at a time when shocking revelations about the irresponsible knee-jerk reactions to any hint of gender dysphoria in children are being made at an alarming rate. You've heard before, we've talked about these skyrocketing statistics. Something that just never happened, for the most part, a generation ago. Now it's happening in increasing numbers. Transgenders are just showing up all over the place, and they're being encouraged. It says here, again, it comes at a time when there's these shocking revelations about the irresponsible knee-jerk reactions to any hint of gender dysphoria in children are being made at an alarming rate, whether it's the girl guides refusing to tell girls or their parents if another girl or leader in their unit used to identify as male. The Tavistock Clinic, Britain's only NHS gender identity service for children, being accused of fast-tracking young people into life-changing decisions without assessing their personal histories. Or schools being advised not to tell parents if their children want to change sex. They're being advised, the educators. Now, don't tell your parents. It quotes some other woman in this article, a doctor, saying this is essentially state-sanctioned child abuse. And she's right. It's child abuse, what they're doing. The article says, when I ask whether it can really be true that children could be sent off to consult with gender clinics without the parents' knowledge, she explains that currently the confidentiality of the trans child actually trumps everything, including the parents' right to know. We've got to keep this confidential. I mean, as far as speech goes, anything goes in this society. But here, we've got to be very careful. Here, we don't want to say anything. Here, we want to hide it. We want to hide it from the parents, because they might disagree. And so it's all about the children, say these government officials, these educators. We know more than their parents. We know more than the children in some cases. And how low do you have to go to start recruiting autistic children, young people, with mental disorders, and to encourage them down this road? Unbelievable. And of course, you look at the articles about this whistleblower from Sunday, and then all the articles in the British papers yesterday and today. And really, the debate is just about, it's just about whether or not parents have a right to know. It's not even about whether or not transgendering is a satanic perversion. We've already accepted that. That's fine, even for young people. But shouldn't the parents know? That's the last line of defense. And even there, the parents are losing. The parents can't even know. They don't have a right to know. This is where we are. And so going back to what we asked in 2016, I mean, where will we be? Where will we be 3, 4, 5 years from now? The Daily Mail, it had a similar piece about this whistleblower saying that, again, making the point about teachers not telling their parents. And it just says outright, we don't want to tell them because the parents might not be supportive of switching genders. And then it talks about the increasing popularity of this on YouTube and websites and such. It says transgender YouTube star Ash Hardell is idolized by hundreds of thousands of teenagers around the world with more than 500,000 subscribers to his video channel. Ash, who was born a female but now identifies as non-binary, neither male nor female, introduces one video about breast removal entitled "I Got Top Surgery" with the words, "Watch my journey to flat and happy." And this transgender tells fans, 500,000 subscribers to his YouTube channel, and he talks about how great the surgery was and how happy he is and how relieved he is. And there's a comment under the video saying, when I get old enough to do this, I'm getting the surgery too, no matter what my parents say. It's another world. A counterculture. British-born Alex Birdie, 23 years of age, also has a hit channel where he has been sharing details of his transition from female to male since the age of 15 with 300,000 followers. How do you explain this? Something like this that was unheard of. It's like the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 5. I went through that with you yesterday. This kind of sin, he said, it wasn't even named among the Gentiles. This is so perverse. It's beyond the pale. Now you have hundreds of thousands of followers. As if we needed the proof, we're seeing it every day. That these are the last days. This certainly is not God's world. We're in the age of Sodom and Gomorrah all over again. Just like it says in Isaiah 1. We declare our sin as Sodom. We love it. We love it. Look, hey, get the parents out of the way. We have to make sure these young people, even if they're autistic, even if they're mentally unstable, we've got to clear the way for them to transition. There's that. And then, as I said yesterday, going through that prophecy in Micah chapter 3, this prophet of God crying out for justice. We're not seeing it. We see judges today who hate the good and who love the evil, just as Isaiah prophesied. And so a few weeks ago, President Trump, he basically said that he would refuse asylum to immigrants, this caravan, this invasion, as the Trump administration referred to it as, this invasion coming up through Mexico. He said that he would refuse asylum to these immigrants crossing the southern border illegally. So if they do it illegally, they're not going to get asylum. They've got to come through legally, said the president. And yesterday, just like we were talking about on the program, a little bit after our program, I suppose, a federal judge in San Francisco, one judge in a San Francisco court barred the Trump administration from refusing asylum to immigrants. You have to give them asylum, says this judge. This judge that no one knows. You have to do it. He's a fellow appointed by Barack Obama 4 or 5 years ago, sitting there in his San Francisco courtroom and just deciding on his own that the President of the United States cannot take this action cannot follow through on that proclamation from November 9th. Fox News reported yesterday as well that there were, well, that caravan made it up to Tijuana, right below San Diego, and Fox said there were 500 criminals traveling with that migrant caravan. 500? And the judge says, let them in. You have no right to turn them away. Give them asylum. Well, you remember what Daniel Horowitz said at his piece. We quoted from it yesterday. Once we erroneously agree to judicial supremacism and to the notion that a single district judge can order the other branches of government to take the most absurd actions, we no longer have a republic, he said. We have a judicial dictatorship. He said further on, a single district judge has more power than the House, Senate, President, 50 state governments, and our entire history and traditions put together. Now, the White House is going to fight this ruling, and it'll probably go up line, but still, look at what one judge can do. Look at what one man can delay for weeks, maybe months. Because he's not a judge, but he's an activist. He's an activist who despises this administration. And so he does everything he can to stonewall it. Just one judge. It could be one of any. One of 1,000 all over the United States. It's exactly what Micah prophesied. You know, we didn't go through Habakkuk 1 yesterday, but you can read through that chapter as well and see about or read about the lawlessness, the spirit of lawlessness, even in the courts. You just can't get a just judgment. Now, my father's talked about God's intervention on the Supreme Court. And that does work to some degree in President Trump's favor. But look at where we are already. Here again, going back to even the first section, all of this nonsense about sex changes, young people, autism, keeping parents in the dark. It's Sodom and Gomorrah. Living in the last days, 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 through 5. Read it. Read what God says about our society, about these perilous times that we're in. It's all described there. Lovers of evil, haters of good, turning things upside down. Isaiah 5, verses 20 through 21. We'll go back. If you didn't hear yesterday's program, there were more examples together with what I just gave you here that made that point, I think, effectively. We have all of our programs posted at thetrumpet.com and at kpcg.fm. When we come back, we'll look at this ongoing European transformation. It's happening fast, and we want to do as Jesus said that we should. We want to watch these events as they unfold and pray always. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
My father's next article coming out in the Trumpet magazine is titled, Germany, a New King is Imminent. You'll be seeing that at the website here coming up soon. Be looking for it. A powerful article bringing together quite a lot of information that he's been discussing on Key of David programs and in other messages over the past several months. He quotes from the former German foreign minister, Joschka Fischer, who said in October that it's no exaggeration to say that 2019 will be the year that makes or breaks the European Union. So we're witnessing the transformation. And you know what we've been saying the last couple of weeks, what we've covered, coming out of France, coming out of Germany, the political turmoil in Germany. George Friedman at Geopolitical Futures, he said, what is clear is that Germany is tired of its political leaders but uncertain of who should replace them. This kind of political uncertainty might not matter in most countries, but in Germany, the beating heart of Europe, it has profound international implications. What are you hearing about these profound international implications? Not much. You're probably not here, unless you're listening to this program or watching the Key of David, you're probably not getting much of this. The Germans are hungry for strong leadership. They're hungry for it. And if you're listening to what the French president and to what the French finance minister are saying, they too are saying, we're hungry. Europe is hungry for leadership. We want our own power and military. We want an empire. That empire is forming. Just waiting for the emperor. My father in that article, the forthcoming piece on this new king being imminent, he said, look through history and you'll find six resurrections of that Holy Roman Empire. Today, the seventh resurrection is staring us in the face. Yet people still don't know what it is. We just don't even know it. We don't even know the history. We're completely unaware of the fact that it's repeating itself. He says that is amazing. Not even the people who live under it know it. Not even the people in Europe know what's going on. They're calling for the empire, the French leaders. And now Angela Merkel herself said, yes, we need an army. Macron is right. My father said, we have to be familiar with the Holy Roman Empire. We have to know this history so that we can be ready for what's coming. But so many, as my father brings out, so many are completely in the dark on this subject. There's a BBC reporter, Steve Rosenberg, just this morning, he posted a little bit on his Twitter feed. He knows Russian, so he's going through these Russian state publications, these newspapers, these state papers, where this one op-ed piece is from a Russian journalist who talks about how dangerous these days are and how that a lot of it has to do with the fact that we're so far removed now from the end of World War II. You go back a generation or two, and for the most part, the people ruling the nations around the world, they had a working memory of what happened there in the 1940s. That's not the case anymore with leaders in Europe, in Britain, in the United States. And so here is BBC reporter basically paraphrasing the content from a Russian op-ed piece in a state newspaper. This is clip one.
Well, this is the Russian government paper, Российская газета, and this article is interesting and chilling. It's by Sergei Karaganov, who is a former Kremlin advisor, and it's about the threat to strategic stability in the world today, the threat of nuclear war, which he says is comparable today to the situation right after the Cuban Missile Crisis, which almost led to a global catastrophe, he writes. He says that the situation is much more dangerous even than in 1914, when a series of mistakes led to the First World War. He blames America today for pulling out of the INF Treaty. He also talks about memory. He says that 35 to 40 years after the Second World War, the people who were in power were people who remembered the horrors of war, people who were really scared of war, especially of a nuclear conflict. But today, he says, the people in power are the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren of those who fought in World War II. And you can feel, he says, the fear of war dissolving. And so he says the most important thing now is not to allow what is looking more and more likely, a big new war that could destroy mankind.
That's looking more and more likely, says this Russian columnist. And notice there, you heard from the BBC reporter, that the problem, I mean the cause for this, is America. That's what President Macron said a couple weeks ago. We need an army because we've got to defend ourselves against America. There is this rising tide of anti-Americanism in Europe, in Russia. It's around the world, in fact. As the world's become an armed camp. And yet, more and more people, as he said, you're looking at grandchildren or great-grandchildren in the positions of power today, and you can feel that fear of war. It's dissolving, even though the signs are there. If you know history, the signs are there. You're seeing some similarities to 1914, to 1938. The Telegraph had a piece this week about Angela Merkel. She's on the way out now, so she's dropping her guard. She's always been known to kind of hold her cards close to her chest. She's not going to come out, and I mean, really, she's resisted against the enthusiastic endorsements of a European army. But last week, as you know, she came out and said, yes, we need one. I agree with France. And they're saying in this piece that she's probably becoming more outspoken now that she's on the way out. She doesn't have to be subtle about it anymore. Deutsche Welle, it had a piece yesterday. Berlin's economic power creates new fear of Germany across the EU. And it mentions that statement, we've referred to it before, the Polish foreign minister, who said in 2011 that he wasn't so much afraid of German power, he was afraid of German inactivity. In other words, get going, Germany. We'll follow you. And that's what France, in a lot of ways, is saying. Get going, we'll follow you. This article, well, it quotes from this German historian, Andreas Roeder, and he said even that Polish finance minister or foreign minister, the statement he made in 2011, he wouldn't have said that 20 years earlier. No one would have. We want Germany to take the lead. Now it's common. There's this new expectation, this article says. This new expectation that Germany is the leader. And all that they're lacking, again, all that they're lacking is the army and the strongman. And that, we're beginning to see, is taking shape. Talks about the dilemma that Germany always faces with respect to these issues. The fact that old fears will be revived. That Germany wants to dominate the continent. Well, that's been the history. That's what's happened. It says there's no simple solution. Roeder, the historian, believes Germany must take on the task in the EU institutions and also, above all, at nation-state level. And in this, he thinks it is more productive if it openly assumes a leading role rather than engaging in backroom politics. Forget about the back-channel deals. Forget about the backroom politics. Just take the lead. Just take the lead. Just go forward. This BBC reporter, he switched over to this other state-run newspaper talking about how Europe, this was another columnist at another paper, but both of them run by the Kremlin, and this one says, Europe needs a military. Europe needs an army. Why? Well, because we've got to get rid of the U.S.-led NATO alliance. That's why. Russia wants that. France wants it. Germany wants it. Listen again to this BBC reporter paraphrasing from one of the Russian newspapers, clip two.
Which brings me on to this article in today's Komsomolskaya Pravda, entitled, Europe needs its own army, not for a war with Russia, but in order to get rid of NATO. And you get the feeling that Russia is keen on the idea of the European Union creating its own army as a counterweight to NATO. In fact, a military analyst tells the newspaper that a European army is more likely to be NATO's undertaker than NATO's partner. And the paper ends by saying this, who knows, maybe Russia could have joint military exercises with a European army, in which Russia will be seen as a partner and not the enemy.
Right, Russia's going to be the partner of the German-led beast power in Europe. They're going to come together in an alliance, just like they did before World War II. In opposition to the United States. This is history, as my father says in that recent article, or the one that's coming out soon, that people are unaware of, that people ignore. Think about, consider that point I made last week, just to reiterate. These are statements, Angela Merkel's letting her guard down. Yeah, now we need a military. Now we need a united army to lead this union. To lead us militarily. Think about what happens when they actually get the strong leader. When they actually get the strong man. Well, my trumpet brief last night kind of summarized some of those programs from last week about France being ready for a European empire, pointing out what the French finance minister said last week. Following that 100-year anniversary of the armistice. And then, of course, Macron's statements as well. We need a real army. We need a real army to defend ourselves, even against the United States. Our Australian office sent this this quote to us this morning from Herbert Armstrong. This is from 1980. And again, this just gives you a great... It shows you how right on top of this Herbert Armstrong was, because he understood prophecy. God opened his mind to understand. What an insight we have into these events, knowing where it's all headed. Mr. Armstrong said, You may be sure the West European leaders are conferring hurriedly and secretly. This is before the wall came down. This is before Europe united. And this is Mr. Armstrong saying that they were conferring in Europe. They were wanting to unite. They were wanting to produce a European military force so that they could defend themselves. He talked about defending themselves from these other emerging powers, Russia and the like. But he says here, a united Europe with a united government, a common currency, and a common military force as great or greater than either the USSR or the USA. It says at the end, they will blame the United States. In other words, it's the United States. We have to do this. We have no choice. America's the problem. America's the enemy. And look at how this is unfolding. That was in 1980 when he said that. Here we are in 2018, and you have the president of France saying we need protection from the U.S., and you have this Russian state-run newspaper saying that, well, yeah, we would love to see a European army, as long as that gets rid of the United States, as long as that removes the United States from Europe. We're all for it. In fact, we may even be able to be a partner with Europe. That's from the Kremlin-run newspaper, as you just heard there. Well, what happens then when the strong man shows up? As I say, my father's been talking about this quite a lot over the past several months. And you can read more about it in the next Trumpet magazine. Listen, though, listen to what he said in May. This is his Key of David program. Strong Men of Europe from May 4th, 2018, clip 3.
When he was defense minister, he revamped and actually reformed all of the German military. Get rid of the old thinking, which was mostly just soldiers in Germany. But he wanted to build an army that could intervene in other parts of the world and protect Germany's economic interest and open up other interests in around the world, like in the Mediterranean, and guard it with this powerful force that could intervene. He wanted a military that could intervene any place in the world. And he had to fight very hard to get it. That wasn't easy to change, but he got it. He did get it. And he said, even talking about the European militaries, he said, look, they're all just doing their own thing, and they should be united. We should be united and have one military power. And he knows that Germany is going to lead that power because they lead Europe already.
I should have set that up better. He's talking there about Carl Theodor zu Guttenberg and his position as defense minister before he resigned in disgrace back in 2011. He was making some substantial changes just in the overall mindset of the German military. And he's kind of been lost from view for 7 years or so. But will he make a comeback? And if he does, will it motivate you to do something with this knowledge you're hearing about day in and day out? Look at how these prophecies are unfolding. It's like my father says at the end of that article, this will be in the January 2019 Trumpet. We're heading into 2019, the next calendar year, just in a few weeks. A new king is imminent in Germany. My father says events in Germany and Europe indicate that the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire is now here. It's now here. He says how sobering this is, but it's also exciting because all of these prophecies, the fulfillment of these prophecies, they usher in the greatest event in human history. The greatest event in the history of the universe, the return of Jesus Christ. And that too is discussed in Revelation 17, which we'll talk about in just a moment. When we come back, we'll go through some of the verses in that powerful chapter, and we'll see what it all leads into. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening. And what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Let's just go through a few of these verses in Revelation 17. You can study this more with some of our booklets, Daniel Unsealed at Last and Daniel Unlocks Revelation, Mr. Armstrong's classic, of course, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast? But here in Revelation 17, it says in verse 1, "And there came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, Come here, and I will show you. I will show unto you the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication." So we know, most of us, that the Bible uses a woman here to symbolize a church. And in this case, obviously, it's a whore, so it's referring to a worldly, a very worldly, Gentile system or church, a religious institution, but it's not God's institution. It's not God's church. This is not a rebellious church of God that went astray. This is Satan's church that is fornicating with the kings of the earth, it says. It's a great whore that mixes with politics. She's like a prostitute. She sells her services to the world, and she presides over many nations that speak many different languages. You can see that in verse 15. Who could this be? Well, look into our booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. Look into it and study this. Like my father said in the article, the one that's coming out in January, people just don't know the history of the Holy Roman Empire. They don't know anything about this church-state arrangement, this union. Verse 3 says, "So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. So here is this scarlet-colored beast of Revelation 17, identified here as the healed beast of Revelation 13. Also, part of it described in Daniel 7. Or part of Daniel 7 refers to this. They all build on one another, these prophetic passages of Scripture. Daniel 2, Daniel 7, Revelation 13 and 17. The seven heads here of this beast in Revelation 17 refers to seven resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire under the influence of this great false church. And the 10 horns are the 10 kings that will assemble together in this final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. Verse 5, notice this, it says, "And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, and the abominations of the earth." It's a great Babylonian mystery religion, the same religion that goes all the way back to ancient Babylon. Today, it's just grown to fill the earth. It's in many, many nations, speaking many different languages. And it's the mother of harlots, protesting daughters that broke free from her dominance, but not really from her influence. Doctrinally speaking, I mean, the mother and the daughters, they believe a lot of the same things. It says here in verse 6, notice how detailed and specific God gets here. "And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints." Here's God's people. But this woman, this false church, that's been the history. She's persecuted the saints of the Most High. She's persecuted God's people. She's drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. "And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration." You know, when Herbert Armstrong died, those that followed in his steps, well, they didn't follow in his steps. That's the history. They turned away from it. But they started saying all these nice things about this great false church. And then the nastiest things about Herbert Armstrong. Only out of the mind of the devil. Completely upside down. They started cozying up to this woman described in Revelation 17 and denouncing the history, the work, the very church that they were in, that God used Herbert Armstrong to raise up. You can't even explain that without an awareness of the great power of the devil, the prince of the power of the air. Ephesians 2 and verse 2. Verse 7, it says, "And the angel said to me, Wherefore did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns." You don't have to be in darkness here. The Bible will interpret itself. We can understand this if we're just willing to do a little bit of study, and if we're courageous enough to face the truth, to face facts. Take the attitude of the Bereans. Have a childlike, teachable attitude, Matthew 11:25. And then let God show you. He'll show you the meaning. He'll help you to understand. Verse 8, it says, "The beast that you saw was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wander, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they beheld the beast that was and is not and yet is." This is talking specifically about the sixth head. Mr. Armstrong was on the scene for that sixth head. As my father says in this new article coming out, the real significance of verses 8 and 10 here, verses 10 in particular, is that it refers not just to the beast, not just to these resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire, but it refers to God's servant Herbert Armstrong. Because he was on the scene for the sixth head. Look at verse 10, it says, "And there are seven kings, five are fallen, and one is," that's six, that's number six, "one is," he's right there, he's right in front of us, "and the other is not yet come, and when he comes, he must continue a short space." Here's an astounding verse the Apostle John carried forward in this vision. When he received this vision in the first century, he was carried forward in this vision to the time of the sixth head, not the seventh, the sixth head. Five are fallen. Those five, by the way, they came and went during this 1260-year period. You can look at that in Revelation 13 and verse 5. 1260 years from the rise of Justinian and his imperial restoration in 554 AD, all the way through to the defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo in 1814. 1260 years. And then after that, it went into this bottomless pit for a time, and then emerged again, starting with Garibaldi in the 1870s and continuing through to the rule of Hitler, that Hitler-Mussolini axis. My father talks about this unique statement, just the setting here in verse 10. One is, and one is yet to come. He says the revelation, this is in Prophesy Again, the booklet, this revelation is about the period when Mr. Armstrong, God's end time Elijah, was doing this work of God. During World War II, we saw the Hitler-Mussolini axis, but then it disappeared. It disappeared from the scene. It was not, and yet God says it is. The Axis powers lost the war, but as Mr. Armstrong preached time and again, they just went underground. Into the bottomless pit. They're still there. They're just underground. So you have these five that are fallen in that 1260-day period, 1260 years, and then the one that is. And Mr. Armstrong said in his booklet, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast, that this sixth head, that it was not in any sense the power-wielding old Roman Empire. So John speaks of it as the beast that was and is not and shall arise once more out of the bottomless pit. It wasn't as powerful as it had been historically. I mean, in terms of mass casualties, you can look at the sixth head and think that it was the worst of all, but Hitler never did build his empire. Not quite. He had the continent of Europe there for a few years, but that's it. The Allies won. The Allies rescued France. The Allies, the American and British Allies, rescued France from slavery. And then finally crushed Hitler's empire. It didn't last for very long. But the Allies will not prevail against this system, against this seventh and final resurrection of the same system. That same old empire, that same spirit of Charlemagne. It's pretty amazing. People can be so ignorant of this history, and yet look at what's coming upon our nations. Look at what's coming upon our people. Seven kings, five are fallen, one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he comes, it must continue a short space. See, during that sixth head, you had America right approaching the peak of its power. Britain, of course, was at the tail end of its empire, but that was the greatest empire this world had ever seen. And so the Allies prevailed. It wasn't time for our nations, Ephraim and Manasseh, to lose all of those blessings and to go off into captivity. But that's what God prophesies for this seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. And so you look at this empire as it emerges in Europe, and then consider, as I covered in the first segment, the problems, the troubles, the curses coming upon our nations. 100 years of the new morality, 100 years of sexual revolution, 100 years of leading the world into all kinds of perverse behavior, like you heard about in the first segment. Well, it says here, just to conclude, verse 12, And the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. This one's going to be short-lived too, but not because a watchman like Winston Churchill is going to rally the nations, Britain and the United States, to push back against this evil system. It's going to be because of God's intervention. It's a short-lived empire, but oh, the destruction. The destruction. The last war, it ended with two atomic bombs. This final world war, it starts with nuclear bombs. It starts with entire cities obliterated. 10 kings, they all come together. Verse 13 says, They have one mind and shall give their power and strength to the beast. They give their power, their strength to this beast headed up by Germany, influenced by this great false church. And then, as I say, you see how it leads into, and my father discusses this in this forthcoming article, you see how it leads right into verse 14. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. They that are with him, if you're with the Lamb, you're called, you're chosen, and you have remained faithful. Mr. Armstrong, in that article way back in 1948, I read some of this to you last week, I believe, but he talked about the revival of that empire in Europe and how that the United States actually helped bring it about. So gullible, so dull of understanding. We can't win the peace, it seems. But he said in that 1948 article, Mr. Armstrong did, he said, I've given you the prophecies on this time after time, the prophecies that we just went through, Revelation 17. I've given you these prophecies time and again and shall continue to shout this warning so long as God gives me breath and freedom. And he says further on, but so long as faithful co-workers stand by me, hold up my hands, he said, and the eternal God permits me to continue and wills that I shall, no power on earth can stop this message of Almighty God. For these last days of this world, the message must go out. God loves this world. God wants to warn this world in love. And so the message goes out, and precious few co-workers, donors, members, precious few are faithfully supporting this end of the end time work. We certainly need more. Jesus said as much in Matthew 9, the harvest truly is plenteous, but the laborers are few. The laborers are few, so pray for more laborers. That's what he instructed us to do. Pray for them. We need them. God's work needs you. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.